a workshop is really, you could say, similar to the concept of my next session on abortion, which is all about narratives. What are the stories we can tell when we're speaking to people on these controversial topics? But whereas the next topic is what are the stories we can tell on abortion, what I want to talk about now is what are the stories we can tell when it comes to assisted suicide and euthanasia? How can we communicate clearly and compassionately? And we've already heard some of that on the topic this morning, and I want to take it down to a very practical level. When you're in conversation with people, what are the points you can make with someone who is not yet convinced assisted suicide ought to be rejected? And what can you communicate to them in that very moment in dialogue? And to begin, I want to tell you a story. And it's a story of two young men. Dan James is on the left, and Matt Hampson is on the right. Now, Dan and Matt, interestingly, are both from here. They're from England, although they've never met each other. And yet, Dan and Matt have a number of things in common. So the first is that they are from England. The second is that both of them, being from here, were placed in rugby as young children. And the third thing they have in common is both of them excelled in their rugby playing. The fourth thing they have in common is, interestingly, when both of them were in their early 20s, while playing rugby, they were hurt in rugby accidents and hurt so severely that leads to their next commonality is that they both became paralyzed. Dan became paralyzed from the chest down, and Matt became paralyzed from the neck down and requires the use of a ventilator. So that's what they have in common, but there is a striking difference today. And that is that Dan is dead and Matt is thriving. Dan traveled from here to Switzerland, where he went to a euthanasia clinic, and he returned to England as a corpse. Matt, on the other hand, volunteers with children at their physiotherapy sessions. He raises money for spinal cord research. He's a motivational speaker, and he is a writer. And I wanted to begin this talk about how to dialogue with others, what stories to share with this particular story, because I believe the story of these two young men identify a key principle that we need to communicate to others and draw them to think in a certain way. And the principle is something that I draw from the insights of one of my favorite authors by the name of Dr. Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. How many of you have heard of the book or the author? Okay, a few hands have gone up. I highly recommend it. Dr. Frankl was a Holocaust survivor and a psychiatrist. So his book, in the first half, is about his experiences during the Second World War in the concentration camps. The second half of his book is about his theories in psychology. And one of Dr. Frankl's insights was on the power of our ability to choose how we respond to whatever is before us. And that we don't have to say, this situation made me do it. But we need to realize we're always empowered to respond to the situation that's before us. The last of the human freedoms, he would convey, that can never be taken from us is the freedom to choose how we respond to our situation. And there are some who, with the thought of becoming paralyzed, you know, imagining, whoa, what if I were to become a quadriplegic tomorrow? That thought could be so overwhelming that many would think, I would want to die. I would want to choose the path of Dan. But the very fact that Matt had the same experience as Dan and yet chose another response is proof that we have power over our how. How we choose to respond to the situation that we're in. To dive deeper into Dr. Frankl's insights, one thing I always like to bring up on this topic that I would encourage you to bring up in conversation with others is this mathematical equation by Dr. Frankl. D equals S minus M. What he meant by that is the following. Despair is suffering without meaning. Despair is suffering without meaning. And here was Frankl's point, and this is what we really need to emphasize in conversation with others. S is an inherent part of the human experience. All of us have suffered, and the bad news is all of us will suffer. But whether or not we despair in light of suffering entirely depends on M. Can we find meaning in our suffering? If we were to put numbers to this, if in the face of suffering the number for meaning would be very high, then the number for despair would be very low. But if we can find no meaning in our suffering, that's the low number, then despair is going to go up. And that could very well lead to a conclusion that Dan chose. Dr. Frankl provides a very powerful example to demonstrate this equation. And he cites a young woman whose experience was similar to Dan and Matt's. She was a teenager from Texas who also became paralyzed. She became a quadriplegic, in her case, as a result of a car accident. And Dr. Frankl said, let me tell you how this young teenager, who cannot move her limbs, let me tell you how she spends her days. She watches the news. She reads the news. She listens to the news on the radio. And then whenever she comes across a story of someone somewhere in the world who's going through hardship, suffering, some type of difficulty, she calls for an assistant to come to her to put a stick in her mouth, and she then uses the stick to pound out letters on a keyboard in order to write notes of encouragement to people that she read about in the news. And Dr. Frankl said, that young woman lives a life of profound meaning, of profound fulfillment and purpose. Why? Not because she's free of suffering. In fact, her life is filled with suffering. But because she's free of despair, because in her suffering, she has filled her life with meaning. So I believe the story of Dan and Matt brings to light that principle, those insights of Dr. Frankl. The next story I want to tell you that will highlight another principle we can bring into conversation is a story of this young girl by the name of, a young woman now, by the name of Zuli. Zuli's from Latin America. As you can see, she doesn't have legs. She only has just a little less than half of her arms. And Zuli was born this way. And she has faced much suffering that exceeds simply being physically different than others. When Zuli was 2 years old, her father committed suicide. When she was 7 years old, she was raped. Throughout her childhood, she was bullied, so much so that when she was about 15, Zuli was tempted to commit suicide. Now, thankfully, Zuli did not follow through on that temptation. And thankfully, she has an incredible mother who has been her number one advocate and cheerleader, who has really taught Zuli to believe that she can overcome her suffering and accomplish great things in life. If you Google her, you can see the incredible artwork that she has painted. Ladies, you can find videos of her putting her makeup on with those arms. It's truly remarkable. And she has shared her story of overcoming hardship, and that has led to media coverage where she's been interviewed on TV. And it just so happened that there was a young man who had also gone through a hard time in his life, and he was so overwhelmed by his hardship that he had prepared to kill himself. He was in a room with a gun in his hands and getting ready to blow his brains out. But before he was at that moment where he was about to kill himself, he had turned the television on previously when he was in the room. And the television station that he happened to tune into was airing an interview with Zuli. And he got distracted by Zuli's story and got captivated and drawn in to all she had experienced and overcome. And he put his gun down and he just sat and listened. And he was so moved that instead of picking that gun up and killing himself, he picked up a pen and paper, wrote her a letter, and has since become her friend. Now contrast the story of Zuli and that young man with the story of Will. Will, when he was in his mother's womb before he was fully aware, was nonetheless a victim of dysfunction and disorder. Tragically, his father abandoned his mother while she was pregnant with Will. She carried through with that pregnancy and was doing the task of single parenting. And tragically, she was afflicted with paranoid schizophrenia. So when Will was 5 years old, she attempted to kill him with a butcher knife. She didn't succeed. He was sent to live with his brother. She was sent away. Will lived with his brother until he was 9. He didn't live with his brother beyond the age of 9 because when Will was 9, his brother committed suicide. Before Will was 10 years old, he was living on his own. But he's like all of us, made for relationship. made for connection. We image God, who is a communion of persons. We are made to be a part of a communion of persons. And Will lacked that, but because he was made for it, he sought it out, unfortunately, in the form of a gang. Getting involved in gang activity throughout his teenage years, when he was in his late teens, he committed murder. Because he's from the state of Texas, if you commit murder, you may get the death penalty. And Will is no longer alive today, because that was his fate. Now, you might be thinking, why in a talk on assisted suicide are you talking about this guy in Texas who got the death penalty and this young woman without limbs in Latin America? And here's the reason why I bring up those stories. The great Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality and tied to a single garment of destiny." He said, "Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." In other words, no man is an island, and we see that principle brought to life through these stories. Zuli was impacted by choices other people made around her, but she also impacted other people by her choice not to kill herself, but to press forward. Had Zuli ended her own life saying, "It's just my life, my absence will have no impact on you," that young man who was going to kill himself would have fallen through, because he never would have heard her story. Will was impacted by his father, his mother. His mother was impacted by his father and others. Will was impacted by his brother. He impacted other people. The choices that we make or don't make, our presence or our absence, has a profound effect on society. And so when it comes to the assisted suicide debate, when people say, "Look, it's just my life, if I get assistance with my suicide, it has no impact on you," we can draw on these stories to prove that claim false. And we can make the point that, for example, an elderly person who has assisted suicide may have a neighbor who a year or so later is thinking about their former neighbor who is no longer around, and is thinking about themselves, thinking, "You know, I kind of feel like a drain on my family." And they may put forward a request for assisted suicide, not because deep down they want it, but because no man is an island, and because they're impacted by the choice their neighbor made a year prior. And they think, "Well, because she did it, and she's not this, this, and this, then maybe I should do it so I'm not this burden," and so on and so forth. So when people try to claim that their choice of assisted suicide, the legalization of it, affects only them, we can draw on these stories as analogies to make the point that that's false. And the next story we can draw on in conversation is the story of Jewel Shuping. As you can tell from this photo, Jewel is blind. But Jewel is not blind by accident or disease or cancer. Jewel is blind by choice. Jewel has a condition called body integrity identity disorder. In short form, it's referred to as BIID. People with BIID have healthy bodies, but their minds are convinced that their body should be unhealthy in some way or maimed in some way. In Jewel's case, she was convinced from the time she was a young child that she should have been blind. Her eyesight was perfectly normal, but she says as an adult that she always wanted to be blind. People with BIID perhaps more often manifest that condition, not so much with a desire for blindness, but with a desire to become an amputee. Someone with BIID will go to their doctor and say, "I beg you, doctor, please amputate my right arm," or, "I beg you, please cut off my left leg." Now, this is kind of hard for us to wrap our minds around, because we think, why would you want that? If there's no gangrene present, there's no pathology, why would you want that? And yet, that's the reality of some of the conditions of the mind. These individuals are convinced that's how they think they should be. So in Jewel's case, she claimed it was sometime around her early 20s where she convinced her counselor to put Drano, which, if you use that term over here, but you would clean your and unclog your bathtub drain with this very strong chemical. She claims that she convinced her counselor to put Drano in an eyedropper and drop it into her eyes. And that led to her blindness. And I can tell by our reaction, we think that is terrible. And of course, it is. So here's the principle the story reveals. We humans have all kinds of desires. Some of our desires are very ordered and good. other desires are disordered and bad. And the very fact that someone has a desire or a wish, that alone is not what we should use to determine whether we follow through with helping them. We don't say, oh, you want it, therefore I'll help you. We say, oh, you want it? Let's analyze it first. Is that an ordered desire or a disordered one? If you have an ordered desire, sure, I'll help you fulfill that. But in Jules' case, we all can readily, obviously see, gosh, that was a disordered desire. And the counselor who brought about her blindness did something wrong. Someone who would amputate a healthy limb does something wrong. They're following through on a desire that, because it's disordered, should not be followed through on. If we can accept that principle there, we apply it now in the assisted suicide debate. Yes, we acknowledge the person desires their death. They say they no longer want to live, but because that desire is disordered, then we shouldn't follow through on it. Now, some people might say, but it's not a disordered desire, it's very ordered. And so in a moment, I want us to explore the main reasons why people have for assisted suicide, some of which we saw on the study that was put up Dr. Wee's presentation. So we're going to look at some of the reasons people have in order to be able to explain further why this is a disordered desire. But again, in conversation, we can use Jules' story as an analogy to make the point that we don't follow through on someone's desire simply because it's a desire. We first make sure it's ordered. The next story I want to tell you, I'm going to tell you in video form, so I will let the video clip speak for itself.
The iconic beauty of the Golden Gate Bridge. On a clear day, picture postcard perfect. But on the day we met Kevin Berthia, gray skies shrouded by fog, perhaps befitting.
To actually get on the bridge for the first time, it was horrifying.
This is the first time Berthia says he's walked onto the bridge since his suicide attempt 10 years ago.
The wind, the noise, the traffic. The people, it brings me right back to that very moment where I nearly jumped.
Frightening, he says, but necessary.
The more and more I accept who I am, and I know that that wasn't me, it's just a part of who I am, but it's not who I am and it doesn't define me, it helps me move on.
On March 11th, 2005, Berthia was the desperate 22-year-old captured in this photo. Battling depression for as long as he could remember, he said he had abandonment issues because he was adopted. And Berthia says he was grappling with being a new father of a premature baby, and he had just lost his job. He drove to the bridge, walked out, and climbed over the railing. Then he heard a voice.
I approached it very slowly and asked his permission for him to allow me to come up and speak with him.
Sergeant Kevin Briggs, whose job was to patrol the bridge for the highway patrol, said he didn't do much talking.
That's what a lot of people need, is just someone that will listen to them.
After an hour and a half of listening, the turning point came when the two spoke about Berthia's firstborn, a baby girl 1 month shy of her first birthday.
She kind of made me understand that I need to be here for her.
With the sergeant's help, Berthia climbed back over the rail, but his battle with depression was far from over.
It took me 8 years to just even confront that was me on the bridge.
And for 8 years, there was no contact between Berthia and Sergeant Briggs. But 2 years ago, the sergeant reached out to Berthia's mother to see how her son was doing. I asked the sergeant why he didn't contact them sooner.
If I contact them, maybe I could trigger something in them to go back to that day, and I don't want to do that.
But in May 2013, the two men were reunited in New York City for the first time since the suicide attempt. Berthia was invited to present the Lifesavers Award to Briggs, given by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. It was then, Berthia said, that he finally confronted what happened that day on the bridge, when he saw the photos of himself on the bridge through the eyes of the audience.
I wanted to hide it. I didn't want to talk about it. And the more and more I talk about it, it has helped me. And the more and more I talk about it, it's helped people.
Now the father of three, Berthia recently found a new job and hopes to marry his fiancée. Once lost, now a newfound sense of peace and happiness.
I just focus on going this way. I don't worry about going back. I don't worry about left, I don't worry about right, I just worry about forward.
Monday I got the job and the car went out Monday. All we can do is laugh.
The job or the
now able to laugh at life's obstacles instead of despair. Bound by fate, the two men say they talk to each other often.
We are going to stay friends forever. We're brothers, so to speak.
They plan to appear together to speak publicly about suicide prevention.
The biggest, hardest thing I had to do was take a step. And that's the hardest thing anybody has to do, is take that first step.
A step forward in the never-ending journey of self-discovery and acceptance. Amber Lee, KTVU, Fox 2 News.
I believe that story, that again we can bring to conversation with others, brings to light a principle that I propose in the form of a question. And it's a question that one of my former colleagues and another friend of mine, Laysa Lane and Jonathan Van Meeren, have proposed in a book they've written that I highly recommend. It's one of the best summaries I've read of how to make a non-sectarian argument against assisted suicide to our culture. And in their book, they propose the following question. Who gets suicide assistance and who gets suicide prevention? In other words, if you're walking down a bridge the way Sergeant Briggs was, and you see someone is on the ledge and they're about to jump, how do you decide whether you push them off or pull them back? How do you decide? Now, in the context of the assisted suicide debate, if you were to not reference this story on suicide that we just watched, isn't it funny, I'll pause for a moment, isn't it funny how we're all repulsed by suicide until we throw the word assisted in front of it and then suddenly it takes on a whole new meaning to our culture? But if you were to ask those who support assisted suicide why, they would often throw out the word we heard in the talk this morning, autonomy. It's all about autonomy, what the other person wants. So then you could give an example and say, okay, you know, if you have an 80-year-old woman, she's had cancer, chemo's no longer working, it's spread throughout her body, she's told she's got 6 months left to live, and she says she wants assisted suicide, she doesn't want to go the whole 6 months, she just wants it all over in a week. Would you support that on grounds of autonomy? They would say, yeah, good example, exactly. And then you say, okay, well then if it's about autonomy, then imagine it's not an 80-year-old woman, imagine it's Kevin Berthia, the young man who wanted to jump off the bridge. But instead of trying to jump off the bridge, let's imagine he puts in a request for assisted suicide. Would you help him with his suicide in that case? And more often than not, the individual will suddenly say, oh no, no, I wouldn't assist with his suicide. There are extremists who would, but I would say the vast majority would support assisted suicide for that grandma case I gave you, but not for Kevin Berthia. And the examples that I've just proposed, you propose, smoke the other side out and prove it's not about autonomy. If it were about autonomy, then they should give suicide assistance to Kevin Berthia the way they would give suicide assistance to the 80-year-old grandma. But if they give suicide assistance to her and suicide prevention to the other, then no longer is it about autonomy, but actually judgment. I'm judging she's not a life worth saving, but you are. And who are we to judge that that isn't a life worth saving? If we believe all humans are equal, then rather making a judgment worth saving, not worth saving, we should give suicide prevention equally rather than only selectively. So those are several stories that I think could be helpful for you to reference in conversation because the story makes the principle more clear. Having said that, I think we need to be able to directly address reasons people have for assisted suicide. And as we saw with the one study that Dr. Wee referenced, there are many reasons. There's five in particular that I want to highlight today. And as I highlight some of these reasons people have for assisted suicide, I want us to be able to be equipped, which I'm going to do, how to illuminate the pro-life responses to these reasons as alternatives to the motivation for suicide. So if you look at the first reason you'll sometimes hear, whether statistically it's the reason or it's more just in conversation, people think, oh my gosh, if I'm in pain, I would want assisted suicide. We can agree with them on something. And what we can agree with them on is that's a problem. I agree, if someone's in pain, we need to respond. And then we say, rather than responding with assisted suicide, couldn't we choose an alternative path? What about pain management? What about developing better pain meds? If we kill all the people whose pain we currently can't eliminate, what motivation do we have to get better pain meds, to develop better medicine? Isn't it only when we have the presence of someone whose illness or pain we can't solve that we have that heightened motivation to address it? The next point we can make is that we have advanced greatly as a society to be able to manage pain that 10, 20, 50, or certainly 100 years ago, we could not control. Having said that, when we make the point that we can control a lot of people's pain, we need to be intellectually honest and acknowledge that there is some pain that can't be entirely eliminated. And the question I often ask people is this: how can we get creative about alleviating someone's suffering without eliminating them, the sufferer? How can we get creative about alleviating someone's suffering without eliminating them, the sufferer? We can still manage pain, so to speak, without medicine. We can surround that individual with a community of people and a type of life in which they still find meaning, if we think back to that equation from Dr. Frankl, even in the presence of pain. I want to play for you a short video of a young boy from Canada by the name of Jonathan Petra. As you can see here by the date, he very sadly passed away almost a year ago. It was April last year. Jonathan died of a rare but brutally painful condition called epidermolysis bullosa. In short, it's referred to as EB. Children with EB are often called butterfly children. And that's because their skin is as fragile as a butterfly's wings. So they develop these terribly painful scabs and sores all over the surface of their body. Any pressure, they often fear falling because the contact with the floor would result in more blisters. It would be painful. They often develop blisters internally. So swallowing food, the friction of chewing and swallowing food is agony. So they're often tube-fed as a result. And so I want to play for you a short clip of an interview done with Jonathan 4 years before he passed away, because I think this clip both acknowledges pain is a very real experience for some people, but shows us that it's possible to alleviate that pain in other ways than just pain medication. So let's take a look.
Where do you get the strength to get up every morning knowing what you're going to have to go through?
That strength comes from the people around me, because they do believe in me that I can get through it.
For years, Jonathan believed he was the only one going through the pain. Until 2012, when he was invited to an EB conference in Toronto. It was a conference that changed his life.
Condition. I had never, you know, had any explanation. I had never known there was anyone else.
How did you feel when you saw the other kids that had it?
I knew that I wasn't alone anymore. I knew since then that I was going to become, you know, an ambassador. I wanted to start helping other people with EB.
In October of 2014, Jonathan put his story out to the world. With the help of the Ottawa Citizen, Jonathan courageously revealed his wounds to the masses. The article went viral throughout Ottawa and landed on a special team's doorstep.
I read it and it was so moving that I brought the article in and we talked about what we could do to help in any way we could.
November 20th, 2014. The Ottawa Senators invite Jonathan to a game and make him a scout for the day. He signs a pro contract from GM Brian Murray and takes questions from the media.
Is there any one particular area of the Senators you're going to be focusing in on tonight, or is it the whole team that you're going to watch?
A team isn't just made of one player, it's all of them, so I'll be watching the whole team.
The Ottawa Senators are proud to welcome their newest professional scout to the organization, Jonathan Witt.
Since his day with the senators, Jonathan has helped raise over $100,000 for EB awareness. There is no cure for epidermolysis bullosa. Most butterfly children don't make it to the age of 30. It's a reality 14-year-old Jonathan deals with head on.
Have you thought a lot about the future?
Definitely. Evie's a cruel thing. And yes, I've thought about it for sure. Like, how can't you? He knows it's a reality. But I think I just pushed that aside. You know, I'm here, and I'm gonna go step by step, day by day. And you never know what the future holds. I may live to 100. We can't know. But I'm not gonna stop anytime soon. I'm gonna keep going.
EB is a cruel thing. Incredibly cruel. But having watched that video many times for many audiences, what has continually struck me is the theme of team. When he's asked, like, how do you get out of bed every day? What does he say? It's the people around me. When he's asked, well, which hockey player are you gonna watch on the ice? All of them. A team is made up of more than one person. And interestingly, it was not Jonathan's own experience of epidermolysis bullosa that compelled him to become an ambassador for EB awareness. What was it? What did he attend? A conference where he met other kids like him. And he looked in their eyes and he knew their suffering. And he knew their pain. And he thought, oh my goodness, I'm not the only one. And it was actually a desire to help others that gave him meaning in his suffering to become an ambassador for EB awareness, to raise $100,000. And so that's what I think needs to be our response when someone's in physical pain. First of all, how do we work to develop better pain meds, come up with cures and so forth? But how can pain management look like community, connection, meaning, and purpose? The next reason that's related to the first, although it's often only described as the first reason there, is emotional pain. And again, we can agree on something. That's a problem too. We need to respond to that and not let someone languish in their trauma. Rather than respond with assisted suicide, why not counseling? Why not get to the root of the problem? To give you an example through a story of how these two are connected, there's a palliative care physician back in my city in Canada, in Vancouver, who told a story of a patient of his by the name of Alice. And he said Alice had end-stage lung cancer, and so what was very normal was that she would be experiencing pain in her chest. What was abnormal, he said, was that he couldn't control her pain. And he said he had so many patients with her type of lung cancer, he could always control the pain. Alice was different. He said she would lay in bed, screaming, writhing in pain. And he was perplexed at why he couldn't manage it. He got an idea one day. He goes into the room. He gently sits on the end of her bed. And he put his hand on her arm. He said, Alice, I'm wondering if I can't fix the pain in your chest because I'm wondering, Alice, if it's a pain I can't touch. He said, is it possible, Alice, the pain is in your heart? And this look washed over her face of being understood, and she opened up and she said, Doctor, I have one daughter, and she's in a relationship with a man I think is really bad. I think if she marries him, her future, it will be misery. And because I'm dying, and I don't have much time left on this earth, and I'm certainly not gonna be around for my daughter, I thought I should warn her. I thought I should tell her what I think. And when I told her what I think, she has disowned me. And in that moment, the doctor realized he couldn't fix her physical pain because physical pain wasn't the problem. It was an underlying emotional pain that happened to be manifesting physically. And if we really care about people, when we find ourselves in these conundrums, these mysteries we can't solve, then we need to keep probing, digging deeper until we get to the root, and then we know what to address. Counseling, help repair fractured relationships or help people let go of that thing they can no longer control. There's a country song that came out probably maybe 2 decades ago now, maybe in the 90s, by an American country singer by the name of Tim McGraw. And he sang a song about, at least one couple people know that name. He sang a song about a man in his early 40s who got diagnosed with a terminal illness. Anyone know the song? I went skydiving, I went, no? Anyone? Rocky Mountain climbing, and then he did like 2.7 seconds on a bull-linked Fu Manchu. So he like does his bucket list, but here's why I bring up the song. It's the next part. He sings, I loved deeper, I spoke sweeter, and I gave forgiveness I've been denying. And then he sings, I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying. And so I think that is what the pro-life response is when the reason is emotional pain. We need assisted suicide. It needs to be no. We need to help people love deeper. We need to help people speak sweeter. We need to help people give forgiveness they've been denying or receive forgiveness that they've been denied. Another reason that can come up in conversation is that someone feels like a burden. I believe that was one of the high ones on the list of Dr. Wee's stats there. And again, we agree. That's a problem. We agree it can't be unaddressed, can't be left to be overlooked. We need to respond. It doesn't follow that because we agree that's a problem, the solution is assisted suicide. What about helping someone change their perspective? And perspective is really what Frankl's whole philosophy is about. I maybe can't control what's in front of me, but I can control how I respond to it. So when someone feels like a burden, we can say, you know, I agree with you, there is a burden present. You're right. There is a burden here. But let's change our perspective and see the burden not as you, but as the disease, the disability, or your age. And because you have been saddled with that burden, and I love you, then I want to enter into that experience with you in order to lighten the load. An analogy that you could bring up in conversation is to say, imagine you're walking down the road and you see a little old lady barely able to walk because she's carrying so many bags of groceries. One looks like it's about to burst open. She's burdened with heavy bags. Now, if you notice this, hopefully your immediate reaction will be to run over and take a few bags and help her carry them. Why? Because you want to lighten the burden. You don't look at her walking with all the heavy bags and think, oh, look at that old woman, what a burden she is. No, you say, oh, look at all those bags, what a burden they are. And when we care about people, we lighten the burden. So we want to help people shift their perspective from I am the burden to the disease, disability, or age is the burden, and then we enter into sharing that with them. To give you an example, a story you can reference, I watched a documentary of a woman who wanted assisted suicide. She was diagnosed with a debilitating disease that would require increasingly more assistance. And her story unfolded in this documentary, which included that she was recently divorced. It appeared her ex-husband was not in her life. It also appeared she didn't have much of a support network. She had one child, a daughter who was 18 years old, just finishing high school and preparing to go to university. And the daughter was planning on postponing going to university in order to stay home and help her mom. The mom then wanted assisted suicide. Why? She felt like she was a burden. And what comes to mind when I think of that story is a quote from one of the former Catholic popes, St. John Paul the Great. And the quote that I reference from him, I don't know if I said story or quote, but it's a quote from St. John Paul the Great. Whether someone is of a different Christian denomination, a different religion, Sikh, Jew, Muslim, or no religion, I believe people of all denominational backgrounds or lack thereof could be compelled by the words of St. John Paul II. And he said in a little document he wrote called On the Christian Meaning of Human Suffering, suffering unleashes love. What a profound statement. Suffering unleashes love. If you think about it, when do we step outside of ourselves? Isn't it when we see another person who's needy? They're weak, they're vulnerable in some way, and the presence of their need causes to well deep within us a desire to help, to love. And so the presence of another suffering is a profound opportunity to unleash love. And I was thinking of that when I thought of this teenager planning to not quite go to university in order to care for her mom. And I thought, she will learn more in the school of love, caring for her mother, than she ever would at a post-secondary institution. When someone feels like a burden, we help them shift their perspective so that they see their suffering can unleash our love. The next reason that can come up in conversation is not simply that someone feels like a burden, but they feel useless. Skip ahead here. And again, we can agree that's a problem if someone feels that their life is not worth living because they feel they can no longer do things. Rather than responding with assisted suicide, why not respond by helping them see their self-worth? That ultimately, our value and our dignity should not be grounded in our usefulness, but rather in our identity. One of the documentaries I watched was of two older gentlemen that were traveling to Europe, I believe they were in Australia, to have assisted suicide at a euthanasia clinic. And one of the men had been a surgeon. The other one had been a university professor. Neither could continue their careers because of their diseases. And I was thinking to myself, you know, as amazing as it is to be a surgeon, to have life in your hands day in and day out, and to be having the power, the skill, the talent to save that person's life. As amazing as it is as a professor, year after year, day after day, to have be able to change the course of the future by influencing and forming the next generation. The danger that arises with both of those amazing careers is because they're so focused on accomplishment that when the surgeon can no longer do surgery and the professor can no longer do teaching, they think they should no longer be. Their identity got caught up in what they did. And we need to help people think about the words of one of my favorite ads from the Canadian Down Syndrome Society. I love this caption that we should celebrate being. That first and foremost, we're human beings who can do, but even if we can't, if we still are, then we ought to be celebrated. And we can hit that point home even in a more full way with another story. And the story I like to tell is about a program I learned about that's not too far from where I live in the west coast of Canada, just 2 hours south across the U.S. border into Washington State. There is a care home which looks after the elderly that also runs a daycare of young children who are about 3 and 4 years old. And when you see, as you'll see in a moment on video, when you see these two groups come together, you see how relationship, connection, and celebrating being is what ultimately leads to human flourishing. So let's take a look.
What do you see?
A brown bear.
Mary McGovern is 95 years old, and one of her favorite things to do is to read to toddlers.
And what is that? A bird?
A bird.
A bird. What color is the bird?
Red.
Everybody knows that.
Luckily for Mary, she doesn't need to go any further than down the hall to find her young friends.
Oh, see, look in here as a little kid. See
that? Oh, yeah.
McGovern lives at Providence Mount St. Vincent, a nursing home in Seattle, Washington, that also houses a daycare for children up to 5 years of age. Every weekday, 500 residents are joined by 125 children in the facility affectionately called the Mount.
Peek-a-boo. I see you.
Administrator Charlene Boyd.
We wanted to create a place for people to come to live and not to come to die.
So in 1991, Boyd and other administrators added a high-quality preschool to the nursing home and created an intergenerational learning center, a community for the very old and very young.
Why is there this railing here?
This railing is here not for the kids, but it's here for residents. And it's a safety piece for a resident in a wheelchair to push themselves up and to hold on and to bring themselves to a standing position and watch the children through the window.
So they can stand here and look in.
They can stand here and look in. It's putting high quality child care in a setting that links old and young together.
Have a nice day.
Making the magic between these two ages together, bringing joy to the residents and joy to those young children. It's just like this magical formula that happens every day.
I get a high five. There, she knows how to do a high five. Most of them, they're curious about me, why you're here. I tell them I'm here because when I was living in my house, when I got too old, I wasn't always walking straight and sometimes I would fall. And if I fell, I had to have some help to get up because I couldn't get off the floor. I want to hug your baby doll.
I think there are things that both parties take away from the interaction. It's not like a lifelong relationship, but just for that moment in time, they're both enjoying each other's company and getting something out of their relationship with that person in that moment.
Give me a hug. Come on. Good hug.
All of us have common needs to be recognized. All of us have common needs to be loved. And all of us have common needs to share life together.
All of us have common needs to be recognized, to be loved, and to share life together. And that's ultimately what needed to be communicated to that professor or that surgeon who thought their lives were not worth living because they were useless. They did not need to do surgery. They did not need to teach classrooms of students as much as they wanted to. And those desires were understandable. But they did have needs. They did need to be recognized. They did need to be loved. They did need to do life together with other people. But the good news is those needs can always be met. Can always be met, regardless of the circumstances someone is in, and that's what we should do. The final main reason that I want to address today that people may propose for assisted suicide is fear of a bad death, whether real or imagined. They may have journeyed with a loved one who had a seemingly brutal death, or they may think that stuff they've heard from others could be their fate. And so we acknowledge that that's a legitimate fear. We need to respond to that fear. And yet it's possible to alleviate the fear and help someone have a good death without orchestrating it down to a planned assisted suicide, down to the year, month, day, hour, minute, and second. And the pro-life alternative would be something like palliative care or hospice, where we place, first of all, people in beautiful environments. All too often, people are in these sanitized, not very pretty places to be. So we create environments, hospice homes, palliative care centers, where you have beautiful art on the walls. You have lots of light coming in the windows. You help people holistically enter into relationship, help them with their final memories, what legacies, messages that they want to carry on, help them repair any fractured relationships, manage their pain, understand there comes a time where disproportionate, excessively burdensome with no hope of benefit types of interventions can be set aside. And instead, we just provide proportionate or ordinary care and comfort measures. There is a palliative care physician that I want to wrap things up by telling you his story. And again, I think it's a story we could draw on. This palliative care physician that I've encountered through just reading about him and studying his work has inspired me greatly. His name is Dr. Bruce Miller, and he's based out of the state of California. And in his work with palliative care, he talks about how important it is to help people, regardless of their age or stage of life, to help people enter into the present moment. And regardless of what pain or suffering they're in, help them find moments of beauty, awe, and wonder, which he says with enough creativity can be done. And so if you know Dr. Miller's story, it's quite profound because although he's this amazing palliative care physician today, that was not always his plan. when he was in his undergraduate degree, doing his undergraduate degree at Princeton University, I believe it was studying like art history or something like that, did not plan to be a doctor. But one night while hanging out with friends on campus, I believe the late night turned into the early morning, he was kind of horsing around with some friends, and he said to one of his friends, where there was this rail car on the Princeton campus that during the day was functional, but at that time was not, he said to his friends, hey, let's climb to the top of the rail car. And so they clamber up there, he gets up there first, he stands up, and there were these cables hanging down. And he put his left arm up, and he had a gold watch on. And 11,000 volts arced from those cables, entering his left arm and exiting out his 2 feet. He almost died. He spent months on a burn unit, and that arm and 2 legs ultimately had to be amputated. I set him on a very different trajectory, where now today he's a palliative care doctor. Through his own experience of pain and suffering and thinking that he at one point was near death, he has many profound insights, and one of the things he talks about is finding beauty and meaning. And he talks about how this one time when he was in the burn unit, there was no window in his room and it was winter time, and a bunch of the nurses coming in for their shift were complaining about a snowstorm which was raging outside. And he said to them it was this negative thing impeding their commute. He said, to me, it was a moment of delight. He said, I couldn't see it, but all I did was shut my eyes and I could imagine it. And I thought about the beauty of snow. That little, you know, white fluff falling to the ground, night light shining on this untouched white carpet that had formed. And just thinking about that was a moment of reprieve for him. Then he talks about how the next day one of the nurses smuggled in a snowball, placed it on his skin. And he says, I can't tell you the rapture, the captivation I felt just staring at the snowball, watching it slowly melt away into water. And he uses that as an example to say, how do we help people find beauty? How do we help them find wonder? One of the things he does at one of the hospice homes that he works at is he said, how many of you, he'll ask people, how many of you like freshly baked chocolate chip cookies? How many of us like that? And he says, exactly, we love when our sense of smell is tickled with this beautiful odor. He goes, so in our hospice, we often bake cookies. He says, most of our patients can't eat them. We don't do it to torture them. They don't feel like eating them, but they like the smell. So we will create beautiful smells. We will create things that make them feel positive rather than negative. And so the last clip I want to play for you is a short section of a bigger talk that he gave at TED. So let's take a look.
We need to lift our sights, to set our sights on well-being. That life can become, and health care can become about making life more wonderful rather than just less horrible. Beneficence. Here, this gets right at the distinction between a disease-centered and a patient or human-centered model of care. And here is where caring becomes a creative, generative, even playful act. Play may sound like a funny word here, but it's also one of our highest forms of adaptation. Consider every major compulsory effort it takes to be human. The need for food is birth cuisine. The need for shelter has given rise to architecture. The need for cover, fashion, and for being subjected to the clock, well, we invented music. So, since dying is a necessary part of life, what might we create with this fact? By play, I am in no way suggesting that we take a light approach to dying or that we mandate any particular way of dying. There are mountains of sorrow that cannot move. And one way or another, we will all kneel there. Rather, I am asking we make space, physical, psychic room, to allow life to play itself all the way out. So that rather than just getting out of the way, aging and dying can become a process of crescendo through to the end. We can't solve for death. I know some of you are working on this. Meanwhile, we can design towards it. Now, parts of me died early on, and that's something we can all say one way or another. I got to redesign my life around this fact, and I tell you, it has been a liberation to realize you can always find a shock of beauty or meaning in what life you have left. Like that snowball lasting for a perfect moment, all the while melting away. If we love such moments ferociously, then maybe we can learn to live well, not in spite of death, but because of it. Let death be what takes us, not lack of imagination.
Let death be what takes us, not a lack of imagination. If we go back to some of the reasons I've featured today for why someone would want assisted suicide, if we look at those reasons and we end with assisted suicide, I would say that's a terrible lack of imagination. A terrible lack of imagination. The pro-life response is to say, let's get creative. Let's develop better pain meds. Let's help get to the root of someone's problem. Let's learn about the power of perspective and changing how we see something when we can't change the thing itself. Let's start to have reflections on what our worth is actually grounded in and help people flourish by celebrating being and in relationship. Let's develop better hospice, better palliative care. Let's get creative. Let death be what takes us, not a lack of imagination. And that is ultimately why assisted suicide ought to be rejected, because with assisted suicide, death doesn't take us. We take death. We grasp at it. And that's fundamentally disordered. We know that's disordered thinking of Jewel. We also know that's disordered thinking of Kevin Berthia, who was going to jump off that bridge. And we know instinctively, wherever you sit on the assisted suicide debate, we know instinctively everyone agrees it was right for that police officer to convince him to come back on to the bridge, because to jump would be disordered. We know it's disordered because we think of Dr. Frankl's insights that despair is suffering without meaning. So it's not so much the elimination of suffering, but the elimination of despair by the insertion of meaning, and helping people get creative about doing that. So I'd like to leave you with a paraphrase of the words of Matt Hampson, who I mentioned at the beginning, the one who is continuing to live amidst his paralysis. And Matt has said, in some ways, he said, my life is good now, and in some ways better than it was in 2005. In some ways better than it was before the paralysis. He said, I feel like a more rounded person now. I look more towards the future than the past. And so it's my hope that with the stories and information imparted to you today, you can use that to help others do the same. So thank you very much.